to leave something better than what I found, and we're having, as a species, a hard time doing that these days. So I have, you know, I've been an activist all my life, pretty much.
Terry, as Peggy said, she was an activist all her life. You were shaking your head. You weren't?
I have never been involved in anything like what we're doing right now. And never thought I could do it. Never thought I would have to do it. But I agree with Peggy. You can see the lake that I live on. And one day, I just stood there and I looked. I have 5 grandchildren, 2 sons, 2 daughter-in-laws. And it's like, I cannot let this happen. I'm a third generation who lives here. And this means so much to me that I could not just walk away from it.
That was Terry Swear, Peggy Case, and Glenna Maneke of Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation at Terry's home in Mecosta County, Michigan. That does it for our special, Thirsty for Democracy, The Poisoning of an American City. If you want to get a copy, go to democracynow.org. And special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, and Dennis Moynihan, and to Kate Levy and No Town, the movie. Happy birthday to Neil Shabata. Speaking of birthdays, February 19th, Friday, marks the 20th anniversary of Democracy Now!'s first broadcast. To help us celebrate, take a photo or a video, tell us who you are, where you tune in, and why you need Democracy Now!, and post it online with the hashtag #HappyBirthdayDN. We'll feature maybe your message on the show. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 8 o'clock. You've been listening to Democracy Now! Coming up next, we have folks from BARC and Salvage Works talking about waste of resources. You'll be able to call in about 10 minutes, 503-231-8187 with your comments. But first, these announcements and a song.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Wamba at the Analog Cafe, Friday, February 19th at 10 p.m. Wamba is a Portland-based band that mixes traditional West African rhythms from Ghana with jazz, funk, and Afrobeat styles. Friday, February 19th, there will be a special 2-set performance. The evening starts at 10 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winter Folk 28, a celebration of music, community, and service on February 20th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Winter Folk, an annual benefit for Sisters of the Road, will feature singer-songwriter, author, and social activist David Roth, headlining along with performers Casey Neal, Sky in the Road, Dan Weber, and Kelly Bosworth. Again, that's Winter Folk 28 on February 20th, from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yeah.
Shut up.
What's going on with the tape deck?
Thank you.
Is Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, as always, Paul Roland. And that was another song by White Gloves. We played Fred and Carrie last week. You can check that out. It's all the rage on YouTube, local Portland band, the White Gloves, talking about what's happening to our town. Nostalgic look at the Division Street that was, and same things happening to so many other streets. We're going to be talking about the changes that are going on, both here in Portland, both negative and positive, and out in the Mount Hood National Forest, where there is a new major proposed timber sale. So our guests are Preston Browning of Salvage Works and Courtney Ray of Bark. Preston is founder and owner of Salvage Works, a North Portland-based company that sells reclaimed lumber from deconstructed buildings and also uses it to make furniture and fixtures. On Wednesday, February 17th, during their afternoon session, the Portland City Council will discuss a resolution to insert into city code language, quote, to require deconstruction for the city's oldest and most historic houses and duplexes. And we'll be talking about that in a bit. Although over the decades, millions of board feet of perfectly good lumber have already been torn up, put into dumpsters, and sent to the landfill, better late than never. And though the resolution obviously doesn't address the question of whether and why and by who any particular building should be torn down, it would prevent throwing away at least some of that beautiful old-growth lumber and, people say, may actually slow down some of the demolition of some of those old buildings, and maybe just force people to think about the pace of changes that are happening and how people can get together and address them. On the other end of the wood cycle, the Mount Hood National Forest has also seen many millions of board feet of wood ripped from its forest ecosystems, milled into lumber, and shipped all over the world. Some of it ended up unceremoniously in landfills. Recently, the Paulale Cooper timber sale was put back on the table after it had been canceled in 2005 after fierce community opposition. Now, twice as large as the original sale, it covers 2,830 acres with 12 miles of road building in the East Fork of the Hood River drainage, 10 miles south of Parkdale. BARC, the Portland-based Mount Hood Forest Protection Group, is actively working to stop this sale and organizing community opposition. And in fact, their community organizer, Courtney Ray, will start off the program with a quick overview of Paulale Cooper. Good morning, Preston.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me.
And good morning, Courtney.
Good morning, everybody.
So, and I also have the tradition of announcing some upcoming events, so people, if you all could just hang with me. I mentioned last week that Rethinking Psychiatry presents Bipolarized. That's this evening. It's an award-winning new film about healing from bipolar disorder. It follows Ross McKenzie as he embarks on a journey to treat his symptoms through alternative treatments and dig up the root cause of his mental breakdown. That's at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth Street here in Portland. That's this evening from 7 to 9 p.m. And there is, BARC, you can talk about the events coming up. There's one in Hood River this evening, I believe.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Comment writing.
You can talk about that. This evening from 6 to 7 p.m., Kramer Hall, fourth floor, room 413 of Portland State, evaluating the potential for fungi to break down polyaromatic hydrocarbons in street sweepings. Jared Kinear from Clean Water Services and Deke Gunderson, the Director of Environmental Studies at Pacific University, will be presenting their research on fungal bioremediation. Learn about how Clean Water Services developed a pilot study with Paul Stamets and his team at Fungi Perfecti through studying literature review and pilot study protocols. The discussion will include the pilot study, Pacific University's role, intern roles, et cetera, et cetera. Another interesting urban ecosystem issue, 6 to 7 p.m., room 413, Kramer Hall, PSU. And I think I'll just hold off there. So, Courtney, what's going on in Mount Hood National Forest? People thought that this timber sale was all over with.
Yeah, thank you. We did think it was all over with. And in fact, you know, a decade ago, we made it pretty clear that people value this area for recreation, for the watershed that serves the community there, and for a lot of the area that has old growth characteristics. Some of those stands are over 180 years old, and so we think it's a very special part of the forest. It's only gotten more special in the last decade, and to have the Forest Service reinstituting this proposal in the face of so much public opposition has been tough, but we know that this is the kind of thing that we love to do. We love to bring people together to protect parts of Mount Hood like this. And so that's what we're going to do again.
So why are we talking about it right now?
Right now is the public comment period, which is something that hopefully a lot of folks are familiar with. It's the opportunity that the public has to engage these decision makers and to supply them with information from the folks who use these areas and rely on them. And so that public comment period will be open until the 25th of February, so next week. And in these final days, we want as many people as possible to be making those statements, whether it's through the websites, by calling your legislator, to call the governor. Any of these methods are going to be helpful in influencing the decision in the end.
So obviously people can go to your website and be, you know, would take their time and look through stuff, find out exactly where to direct their comments, some pointers, some information about the timber sale. So what's that website?
It's barkout.org, barkout.org.
And how about your phone number?
Oh, our phone number is 503-331-0374.
So give people some talking points. Why, you know, what's so particularly bad about this timber sale? Or are you against all timber sales in Mount Hood?
This is a commercial timber sale, which means they're taking out large trees. This is an area that I said has a lot of wilderness characteristics. There's spotted owl habitat. There's a really sensitive watershed. And it's actually an area that is where commercial logging is prohibited. But they are pushing this project forward under the guise of a fuels reduction project, as if to say that they can predict where a fire will be and that logging is the answer, which is just not scientifically founded at all. And so we want to make sure that when public lands are being managed, that the best possible science is being used rather than kind of using this rhetoric, this restoration rhetoric, as a way to get around some of the protections that we've worked so hard to get for places like critical endangered species habitat and the places where drinking water comes from.
So whose watershed, drinking watershed, is this?
It's the Crystal Springs watershed, which serves a lot of Hood River County. It's an aquifer, and so any, you know, water that lands in that area is going to soak through the ground, which means disturbing the soils with road building and logging is going to have a really big impact on the quality of that water as it comes through and eventually into people's municipal water systems.
Of course, people should know, if they don't, that, you know, our watershed here in Portland, where we're speaking, is a Bull Run. There's been decades and decades of fights over exactly the kind of issues you're talking about right there. And of course, we have a lot of listeners out there in Hood River County, some of whom are fighting on another issue that BARC has been somewhat involved in, the effort to stop Nestle from putting a water bottling plant in Cascade Locks. And anybody who heard Democracy Now! This morning and the obscene use of corporate power to suck water out of Lake Michigan and then sell it back to people who are suffering this crisis, water crisis in Flint. We obviously don't have anything like that going on, but it points out the preciousness of our water resources and who knows what the future is going to bring. So again, talk about the event in Hood River this evening.
Mm-hmm. So one of the most important ways that we kind of help folks to figure out how can I engage with the Forest Service, how can I make my voice heard is through comment writing. And so what we want are substantive comments, which are comments that the Forest Service will have to respond to by law from the public. And if those comments have a critical assessment of the legality or other impacts that this project is going to propose, that's going to, you know, put a little bump in the Forest Service's plans. And, you know, in the real world, they should be responding to those comments reactively and changing the project to make it suit what the public really wants and really needs when they're managing public lands. And so tonight in Hood River, our staff attorney, Brenna Bell, will be leading a training to kind of give people an idea of how do you find some of those critical points in an environmental assessment, and how can you make a comment that is going to yield that kind of reaction from the Forest Service. And so that's at 6 o'clock at the Hood River Library in the meeting room that's downstairs right there. I think it's 502 State Street in Hood River.
And do you have any other events coming up?
We have a ton of events coming up. Always check the events page. Tomorrow night is a volunteer orientation at our office here in Portland on 18th Street, Northeast 18th, 351. And so that'll be an opportunity for folks who maybe have volunteered in the past or have an interest in that to find out more about different opportunities and ways they can get involved. And Friday is a kids' night event. So youngsters of all ages are invited to come hang out and watch a movie, do some activities about protecting our special wild places.
And you have hikes regularly.
We have hikes regularly. We have trainings for ground truthing, which is doing field work out in the forest. And obviously we're trying to grab people for rallies and things like that when that's a necessity too.
Mm-hmm. Well, people should be able to find out more, as you said, through your website, and through calling, through going to some of these events. Anything, any other suggestions you have? I mean, should people go talk to the Forest Service? How do people find out more? I mean,
people
should go to the Forest.
Well, they are a public servant. Yeah. You know, yeah. It's a public agency. The more people that they're hearing from, the better. You know, right now, they get a mandate from Congress that 35 million board feet need to come off of Mount Hood this year. And that's without regard to what the market might be, without regard to how much timber are we taking out of old structures. And that's just something that they're kind of held to. And so we see that they're pushing forward because they have a congressional mandate, and that's going to yield some of these, you know, damages to the places that we, you know, the public spend our time and that we find very valuable for reasons, you know, other than the commercial logging interests.
Of course, that's an issue that we could talk about, how that came to be, the million board feet mandate, and how that plays into these, what you, many people consider, I consider sort of flimsy excuses for being able to, because the complexities of the environmental victories that were won in the past in terms of limiting some of the logging, you know, in certain areas, riparian areas, et cetera, so they have to invent these fuel reduction or, whatever.
Restoration.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the salvage logging, all this stuff is something that people have to be aware of, because they keep seemingly reinventing new strategies. And but of course there are good people in the Forest Service. It's just that especially when you're under the gun from a congressional order
to right that. Which is why making a call to the legislator is a great idea.
All right, well, there's much more we can explore on that. We may talk about that some more next week, so stay tuned. And Courtney, hang around if anybody has a particular question for you. But we have another issue to take on as well, which just sort of happened this way. But I think the way these things relate, I think, is really important. I think we really do need to think of things holistically. And, you know, the idea that we're sort of deconstructing, in a very real sense, ecosystems, these natural living ecosystems that we depend on, that are being frayed and tattered around the world at all levels. So the ones that remain relatively intact are increasingly important. And then, of course, more people live in the cities in these kind of bubbles that don't necessarily understand that. And then so we can use all that material to construct this sort of expanding system, artificial system, that keeps demanding more and more energy and materials. It's kind of an insidious, vicious cycle. And on top of that, as these pressures to, capitalize on real estate investments and meet the real needs also of people, some of them even climate refugees perhaps moving to Portland. It's getting really complex, but it just happens, given the way the market system operates, that people are able to leverage their financial power and their capital to make these decisions that aren't in all our best interests. So, Preston,
yeah, Paul,
how did you get into the salvage logging thing? Salvaging beautiful old wood.
Started out in Portland 25 years ago as a carpenter doing remodels on historic houses. And we were often looking for historically appropriate material to put back into these houses. And it was hard to find them. And a lot of what we found in dumpsters from other projects and put them into these remodels. But then the Rebuilding Center opened up, and I started working with them doing deconstruction. And they were basically, it was a novel idea at the time. This would have been 1999. Instead of going in and demolishing a house with a bulldozer, a group of people would go in and dismantle the house by hand. So basically saving reusable materials for resale.
Mm-hmm. And so that, I guess there's limits to that, given that you're not always going to find a dumpster. It's a pretty good bet, actually, on any given night in Portland.
It is.
You're going to find, unfortunately, we can laugh about it, but it's, ever since I moved to Portland 30 years ago, from the very get-go, I was shocked. And I the first winter I lived in Portland, I rebuilt an abandoned shack behind a squatted house. It was covered in blackberries anyway. And I right near where, full disclosure, by the way, which we hadn't gotten into, I actually worked with Salvage Works a year ago for about a month, I think, denailing lumber from a beautiful old growth Doug fir lumber from a warehouse on the waterfront in the Northwest.
That's right, on Front Avenue.
On Front Avenue, not too far from there, on Vaughan, Northwest Vaughan and 23rd, as I say, the first winter I lived in Portland, 85, 86, there was a old factory that they tore down on Vaughan, down on like 20th, and I think that whole area is gone now, but, and there's the office, all these old factories had the office where they had like the really cherry stuff, like nice wainscoting. And anyway, so I got I got paneling, just beautiful, eighth-inch paneling and all my 2x4s to rebuild. I built an extra wing of it and like a little loft. Anyway, so yeah, I've been way into that. In fact, I've dumpster dived some lumber in the past few months. But as I was saying, you obviously started thinking other thoughts about how to do salvage in a more methodical way.
Absolutely. What we're seeing in Portland is a record number of demolitions. The growth in the housing and infill projects is quite large, and historically, for the past few years, more than 300 demolition permits are taken out each year, and the bulk of them are mechanically demolished and crunched up and put in dumpsters, Previously, up until about a year ago, the bulk of the wood waste was actually being chipped up and sent to paper mills for fuel. So recycled, but not in a very high yield. Last year, about 10% of those houses were actually deconstructed by hand with the materials salvaged for reuse.
How much percent?
10%. About 30 houses.
And that was due to just entrepreneurs?
That was the developers making the conscientious choice to do the right thing and you know, it'll make something good out of what is normally just garbage.
Now, you say making the right choice. Now, do they have any economic incentive? Is it in their interest at all to?
Actually, a deconstruction is going to be more expensive than a demolition. A demolition usually takes about 2 days, two people and heavy machinery. A deconstruction can take close to 2 weeks with six people. So it can be 40 to 50% more expensive, but the...
And it slows them down.
It slows them down, which is one of the benefits, I think. It's a more human approach to removing a structure.
Less energy intensive?
Less energy intensive. And then, you know, there's the environmental benefits. You know, houses that are demolished are required to have an asbestos survey and abatement. But that is only what can be seen before a house is demolished. And oftentimes, more asbestos material is found, or it isn't found when it's demolished. But when a house is deconstructed, it's a slow, methodical process. And trained workers know what to look for. So if they find some hidden asbestos, they can stop the job and bring in trained professionals to remove that.
So I just want to interrupt you for a second, because we did say Courtney could stay on and engage in, listen to the conversation, which I think is very interesting to have different kind of interest groups, different aspects of these issues, like interacting. I think it's important. But also if anybody had a particular question for Courtney, so perhaps this caller does. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say that in the early 70s, I had come to the Corbett neighborhood, and it got there were lots of old houses because they thought they could do high rises there, and so there'd be an empty house kitty corner from where I lived, and you'd notice the next morning there was a little bit of wood out of the place, and it's like, hey, you know, I'm not going to miss on this. And so my friend and I took some of the wood out. Other people took some of the wood out. So there was a lot going on in the early 70s. Also scavenging everywhere they could because people were building handmade houses, you know. So it's a long history. Just want you to know that.
Uh-huh.
That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you. It's true. I mean, we are opportunistic creatures, and to the extent that we're able and, you know, have the boldness, because sometimes, you know, people like, you know, dumpsters, you know, in fact, I think it might even be illegal sometimes to go into a dumpster, actually to physically go into the dumpster, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, all these complexities, yeah. All these strange laws and rules and regulations.
Yeah. And Paul, I'd like to clarify something I said earlier. I had said that deconstructing a house was a novel idea. It actually was more of a step back to how it used to be done. So in the past, when houses were removed, they were always salvaged.
Right. Just as, you know, recycling was universal up until like the post-World War II era. I mean,
absolutely.
People like saw things as valuable until there's just so much. It kind of exceeds. I think it's the same thing in the city. It's just like there's so much going on. How do you focus on like one thing? But these conversations are happening. And the reason we're talking about it, as I said at the outset, is there's a resolution that is going before the city council this afternoon. And that will be talking about basically mandating, right? Mandating certain buildings, and we'll go into that. And another disclaimer is, you know, you work for Salvage Works, which is most certainly, if this thing passes, going to benefit directly. So I think we should state that at the outset.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, Salvage Works, the business is based on selling reclaimed lumber from houses that are dismantled. So, yes, this will benefit my business, but it also allows me to employ more people. We have grown in 6 years from 1.5 people to 14. If this resolution that is going before city council today were passed, it will allow my business to grow and hire more people and keep more material out of the landfill.
And possibly allow other people to develop their own business, since we don't live in a socialist you know, system where it'll all be taken care of by, you know, all the people, like in each neighborhood where have their own, you know, whatever, you know, that beautiful model that we're still reaching for. I am anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Within the existing model, people do what they need to do. And, you know, good, you know, visionary entrepreneurs are always a rare commodity themselves.
Absolutely. And I'll say, you know, I didn't get into this business to get rich. It's a hard work. It's a lot of work. But the reason I did get into it is because I was really heartbroken to see all of this material just be crunched up and thrown away. So if more people are doing it, I think that's a great thing.
So I just want to reiterate that we still have Courtney Ray here from BARC. If anybody has any particular questions about this Palali Cooper timber sale before we let her go and shift more directly into talking about this specific resolution that's coming up at 2 o'clock or after 2 o'clock sometime, the number to call is 503-231-8187. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland, and I'm speaking with Preston Browning with Salvage Works, talking about his history in salvaging beautiful old-growth lumber and selling it as is or making things out of it. It's another thing we can talk about, which your business and some other businesses in town are involved in. But also Courtney Ray gave us a quick overview of what's happening with the Palali Cooper 2 timber sale out in Hood River. And again, she's with us for another few minutes, so people want to call up and talk about that. This is your chance to do it. And
I just had one thought, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, this is a really interesting resolution because whether the council intends it to help the forest or not, it's the kind of thing that cities can do to reduce the pressure, you know, that we put on our natural resources out in the world. And I'd really like to see, you know, more kind of focus on what power does the city have to reach out, you know, and protect Mount Hood, the leadership that we have now. There's a lot of future leaders in the works. I think it's an important resolution to kind of start that conversation as well.
Absolutely. And Courtney, can you remind us of how many board feet of lumber?
On Mount Hood, it's a 35 million board foot mandate this year.
Right, exactly. So I am not the only business in town. There's a couple others that reclaim lumber and sell it, and much larger than I am. But last year, we saved 500,000, 600,000 board feet of lumber from going to waste. So yeah. In perspective, the city council, the resolution that's going through city council will require deconstruction on about 100 houses historically, which will, you know, if I did some quick math, would be millions of board feet of lumber. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
And like you said,
see,
you're employing a bunch of people.
Absolutely.
Logging
absolutely.
Is largely mechanized.
Absolutely.
There's kind of a lot of ways to
right.
transfer that
right.
and make that resource more.
Right, so maybe that's where we can get that 35 million board feet of lumber.
That'd be great.
On that note, let's go to another caller. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, it seems that the labor-intensive deconstruction that you're talking about would be a good place to employ a lot of people who don't have jobs and are living on the street. I mean, there's labor intensive. They need the work, and if the city were really serious, they'd find some way to get people involved there with real jobs. That definitely would be a socialistic venture, I guess.
In the interests of society, yeah.
Yeah, but again, on the other hand, having had some first-hand experience with socialism, you talk about it as being a community-up program, but unfortunately, in most places where it's been tried, it ends up being an authority-down kind of system, and the people who've worked in socialistic systems, and especially in Eastern Europe, don't want anything to do with it.
Well, that actually wasn't
anymore.
That wasn't really the conversation we were actually engaging on.
Paul, take it easy.
I'm taking it easy. I'm just saying we got 25 minutes left and a lot to talk about. That's another conversation that is really important. How do we really want to live together? What sort of organization, what sort of society, what sort of political relationships? Those are all very difficult and complex questions. And I agree that the socialist states, I'm not really a socialist. I'm more like, anarchistically, I don't even want to get into labels. It's something that we have to really talk about together. Obviously, what's we got going isn't really working. But leaving that aside for the present, and as we work together towards resolving those questions by fighting particular battles and working together on particular issues, I think. Do we have any other callers? Brian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, yeah, great. Thanks for this show. Some years back, I was doing quite a bit of building and was very excited about rebuilding center and restore. And I think Salvage Works was still going. I was already going. I've had some experience with rebuilding center's deconstruction project. A friend of mine was running that at the beginning, and I got to see them take apart the Amity grain mill and then turn that wood into some beautiful projects. As far as this this new possibility of having the, making sure that they recycle from old buildings, I really love this idea. But I also want, feel a little uncomfortable that it may make the tearing down of old buildings more like have a green kind of tint to it, and make it more possible and make tearing the older houses down. Because I think in this day and age, with some of the new technology in building and even like we see in cars, and appliances, like, oh, we can get an Energy Star rated appliance, or we can get a hybrid car, or we can build this new house with this high energy rating. But I'd like to see more studies about the carbon footprint of that compared with just reusing the old. I have a 1916 farmhouse that I've done everything I can to it, and I'm sure it's not going to meet the I can't remember the name of the label, but anyway. But I do think that overall my carbon footprint is lower. So I just, my only concern is that it doesn't give kind of a green tint to the idea of, well, let's just tear down the old and build new, when in fact maybe the carbon footprint and the benefit to the environment would be better by reusing the old.
Firstly, I want to say that I agree with you 100%. And I personally do not really advocate for the tearing down of these houses. I think it messes with the character and the affordability of the neighborhoods. I agree with you 100% that the environmental benefits of leaving a house standing is much greater than tearing it down and building something new. What this proposal is addressing is more just the fact that demolitions are happening and that we can see something better come out of one.
Yeah, well, thanks for making sure that the materials go to a new home. I've done a lot of rebuilding where I reuse the old material. In fact, I have window sashes that I've made from old wood that have a lot of character and beauty to them. And I believe that the old wood in these houses would probably last 3 to 4 times longer than the new wood that would go into a new house. So they were around a long time before, and they'll be around a long time after if they're allowed to be reused.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. So, we talked about several aspects of this. One thing you mentioned that maybe we could touch on a little more was the deconstruction itself. That's not something that you're directly involved in, right?
Correct. No, I we basically buy this lumber, and I'll just say that Salvage Works, our specialty is the lumber from these houses, so the bones. So we don't do other architectural fixtures like doors and windows.
And there are places that do that.
And there are places. The Rebuilding Center, Habitat for Humanity has four stores called the Restore in the area, and then the sort of traditional salvage places like Hippo, Rejuvenation, Old Portland Hardware.
So you know, that's another job creation thing. Is there's the group, the companies, businesses, that organizations that resell lumber and fixtures and whatever. I mean, you could probably even the light switch plates and Absolutely. Just about anything can be reused. If you want to be really careful about it. And maybe, you know, actually, if you look at it in a serious way, maybe there's actually, you know, it seems like there's more benefits, socially benefits, to, you know, if a building has to be torn down. And we got to look at this really holistically. Like, Absolutely. Does it need to be torn down? Does that building need to be torn down? I mean, there's like a lot of questions, and we're not really addressing any of them particularly well. So focusing on this one very narrow question, which has, you know, touches on a lot of other questions, you know, so there's the dismantling of the house, and you say it takes a train, and you mentioned there's like possible asbestos, possibly other toxic. Obviously, there's got to be training. There's got to be maybe special equipment in certain circumstances. So how many crews like that are there around that do that kind of work?
There are three or four different operations. A couple of them are nonprofit, and a couple of them are for-profit. One in particular runs three crews and takes down a couple houses a month. There are also some traditional demolition contractors who are sort of getting on board with this idea. And so even though they are bringing in heavy machinery for the bulk of the work, they're salvaging a lot more wood than they would have in the past.
Yeah, in fact, the one that I worked on a year ago or whatever it was demolished by heavy equipment.
Absolutely.
But it was a big, huge warehouse. So it was right. The big rafters obviously weren't going to get destroyed.
Right.
And most of the two-bys
right.
Weren't either. So
right.
That was a secondary operation of taking that stuff.
Right, right.
And then denailing it, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, what today's resolution is not addressing is the other demolitions that happen, which are large commercial buildings. So a lot of these big new mixed-use buildings are, say, on the waterfront, are replacing old warehouses. And these are buildings that are 40,000 square feet. And there's a lot of material in those. And so, you know, I would love to see in the future city council addressing, you know, both houses that are newer and some of these other structures that are coming down. But that said, traditionally when warehouses come down, the demolition contractors, there has always been value in the larger beams. And so they're always have been salvaged and sold to operations like mine. But what we're seeing is even with those folks, more and more salvage of the smaller material, like the project.
And there's vast quantities of that. It just seems criminal. Haven't there been regulations against reusing salvage lumber, like building regulations?
There are. Framing lumber cannot be reused in new construction unless it is regraded by a lumber grader, which is a very sort of labor-intensive and costly way to do it. The material that we sell is, I would say, going more for a higher use. So framing lumber is not being reused as framing lumber, but because it is this beautiful, old-growth, clear-grain Douglas fir that also has 100 years of age, patina, and oxygen, it makes it a very beautiful, rich, warm material. So most of the material we sell and we also build in our shop goes into more aesthetic purposes, building furniture, building out commercial projects like restaurants and bars, the bar tops, the tabletops, the shelving is made out of this material.
So do you see any validity to that, those regulations hampering the reuse of lumber?
Oh, absolutely. House structures and houses that are more modern that are coming down have perfectly reusable and can be very affordable building material for reframing. So,
no, what I ask is should it be easier to use framing material as framing lumber?
It absolutely should be easier, but I understand the regulations because obviously there are safety concerns.
Do you think that's another thing that could be? Sometimes I get a feeling that some of these building regulations have actually been put in place by large commercial interests to ensure greater use of material so they get more profit margin.
That's very likely.
Okay, well, on that note, let's go to Nancy. You're on the air, Nancy. Hello? Are you still there? Do we lose Nancy?
I put me on mute. I apologize. Okay.
There you go.
I have a question for Courtney. What are the exact words we should use when we call our legislator to disapprove of what's going on? But just so that there's no confusion for me, I like to know exactly what I should say when I call the legislator.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, say something simple that this proposal is not based on the best available science, that's clear, that you want your public agencies to be functioning at the highest level of credibility, and you can, direct them to BARC's website.
Oh, I could look at your website and find that out. Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what is your website again?
BARC-out.org.
BARC-out.org.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
All right. Thank you for calling. And, of course, the broader issue that Courtney was talking about, is the Paulley Cooper timber sale, but the broader issue of the timber cut, during the heyday of the forest protection movement, there was a lot more, general conversation about these things and a lot more pressure being put on legislators and, well, on the Forest Service itself and through the judiciary now. It's sort of been a long time since the Northwest Forest Plan has been put in place, and there's these continual efforts to undo whatever gains have been made. So maybe these politicians need to feel a little more citizen pressure.
Always.
So, the issue is the fuel reduction is the particular issue, that fuel reduction is not a science-based reason for pushing through timber sales, and so expose the fact that it's actually a congressional mandated level of timber sale cut from our national forests, which maybe the timber sale managers, maybe the managers of forests don't even want to do, perhaps. I don't know.
Opinions are different between different folks who work in the Forest Service. What we do know is that if you're trying to protect houses and buildings and dwellings that people need, it's just, a few hundred feet around that structure. That's where you need to do fire prevention or fuels reduction. And all of these sales that are happening kind of back in the recesses of the forest aren't going to have a real effect on the impact of fire on people's homes and things like that.
All right. Well, getting back to this, the other issue we're talking about, the twin issues involving wood. And so specifically, what will this resolution say? And who's been pushing this resolution? What's it going to do?
What the resolution will be is a proposal to mandate the deconstruction of houses built before 1916, which basically puts it at 100 years or older. And constitutes about a third of the houses that were demolished, say, last year or the year before. And it was closer to 350. So that would be, about 100 houses required for deconstruction.
Mm-hmm. And so, actually, I only have one page of this. Oh, well, I don't know what happened to that. The resolution itself. Okay, here we go. So the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will ensure adequate deconstruction training and certification opportunities are available. So that's something we're getting at with the training. So there's only three crews existing, so there's going to be need to be more crews that actually know how to deconstruct. So how is that going to
Absolutely, and that is part of the resolution. And I'm sorry that to answer your earlier question, this is something that the Bureau of Sustainability and Planning has been working on for many, many years. With the, you know, the idea of a waste reduction, it fits with the city's climate action plan, so part of the resolution is to provide support for training of additional contractors to do this work. And I think everyone sees that the number of businesses that are currently just doing demolition will branch out and basically have a specialized crew that does this deconstruction.
Mm-hmm. And so again, that's this afternoon, sometime after 2 o'clock.
Absolutely.
It's on the agenda, so they'll be discussed. Be it further resolved that provisions are in place to adjust to unanticipated market or labor conditions that occur within the first year requirements. A bunch of more technical things. Deconstruction Advisory Group. Who's the Deconstruction Advisory Group?
The Deconstruction Advisory Group is a panel of interests in this, and it's made up of people who are total advocates of deconstruction and also folks who are a little skeptical of it. So it's a number of governmental agencies, including Metro and the Planning Bureau and Sustainability and Planning, as well as the Permit Office. It's made up of representatives from neighborhood groups, the nonprofit salvage industry, the for-profit salvage industry, as well as developers, demolition contractors. So it's a very diverse group.
Mm-hmm. And they were able to come up with an agreement on...
Absolutely. I mean, this is a group that I sat on, and we met over a dozen times in the last 6 months to look at ways to increase the deconstructions. Through some grant funds, there's been a program to give small grants to developers who will do deconstruction, and that is mostly to give the agency, you know, the bureau more data to really see what the benefits are and what the drawbacks are.
So we only have a few minutes left. If anybody has a last call here, 503-231-8187. So how about, you know, is this something you talked about at all, direct reuse of framing lumber? Is that conversation ever come up?
Yeah, it absolutely has. And like I said, it's codes are a hard thing to break. They're obviously in place for a number of reasons, safety concerns.
But how about this grading? I mean, couldn't the city, then that gets into real, you know, quote, social.
Yeah,
these get into really difficult questions that we got to face. I mean, if that's the obstacle, all you need is a person or group of people to regrade the lumber to make sure that it's safe to use. I mean, that seems like an obstacle that should be able to be overcome.
Absolutely. And there are graders out there. And it is, you know, it is currently done with larger beams. People who want to reuse large beams, not only for structural, but for the aesthetic of it.
Right. But that becomes, that's a financial thing because the density, the value of a large beam is such, there's limited numbers of them, whereas there's larger numbers of smaller things that take a lot more time. So all these things, it's all this whole this whole skewed, relationship between time, money, economy, profit that we have to break. And so seems like these are good places to really start challenging.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, like I said, these materials are being reused for a sort of a higher use, an upcycling, as it were, because of the character and the density and the quality of the lumber. The barriers for reusing that material for framing. I mean, one, it is expensive as far as, like, say, a 2x4 goes. You know, you can go to a lumber yard or a big box store, and I believe it's too cheap because the a real value is not being put on this material, but you can get a 2x4 for $2.
That's exactly, you know, the whole idea of the, you know, the what we're losing in terms of, quote, ecosystem services.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation, which we probably can't have right now, unfortunately, although that...
Just come by Mark's office.
Come by, yeah. Or stop by Salvage Works.
Stop by Salvage Works.
And, but we do have a last caller here. Adriana, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, my name is Adriana. How are you?
Good.
So I just wanted to mention that I have actually been working with the Rebuilder Center, and I have never actually had a chance to stop by Salvage Works. I'm actually at the branch manager of Labor Ready. And so we've had the opportunity to work with the Rebuilder Center, and I'm just wondering, is there any need for any type of laborers over at the Salvage Center, at the Salvage Works?
Adriana, we always have need for good help, so feel free to give us a call or come by anytime. We're open 7 days a week.
Definitely. Okay, I will definitely stop by there then. Thank you.
And think of, like, maybe if this, if and when this resolution goes through, to actually organize, you know, it's a big, you probably not you, but I don't know, somebody out there to, you know, organize some new, a cooperative, you know, to, you know, there's going to be a lot more stuff available, unfortunately. But again, you know, we're dealing with the super rapid nature of the way these things go, and trying to, you know, I remember this is a conversation I wanted to start earlier, that I worked for Sunflower Recycling, you know, back in the late 80s and 90s. And it was, you know, it was a beautiful thing. I mean, just to, the whole idea of Sunflower was, you know, there's this vast amount of stuff. We were basically the first residential recycling outfit in the Northwest, maybe in the nation, actually. You know, that was the idea of diverting stuff that was just going into the landfill. And ironically, I remember that Bullseye Glass, which is now in the news for apparently heavy metal pollution, I used to take on the forklift a load of clear transparent glass over to Bullseye, thinking I was doing such a great job, you know. Anyway, the contradictions are endless, and we have to be ever vigilant. And I guess we got one more call, and we have a couple minutes left. Squeeze that one more caller in. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to mention, I spent some time in Berkeley, California, and you can't tear down a house in Berkeley. You have to fix it up. So this deconstruction thing is like a half measure, just to say.
Absolutely, I would agree with you there, and I would love to see more regulations in the city to limit that, the demolition or removal of structures.
There's another fight. Unfortunately, there's just so many of them. We try to cover what we can and encourage people in their work and other people to get involved, and there's so much more. But thank you all so much for coming in. This has been a wonderful conversation. Any, you know, should people come out to this, to the city council and check out this, hearing?
Absolutely. You know, I've gone to a few in the last, year or so, and it's quite an experience, and it feels good to sort of witness our government in action firsthand.
And even sort of participate.
And participate.
And people can testify?
They can testify. There's a sign up is at, I believe, 12:30 or 1, but it's on the city's webpage.
Okay. So go to that. Again, that's a resolution to mandate deconstruction rather than demolition of a certain percentage of houses and duplexes built before 1916. And obviously there's a lot of things that it leaves undealt with, but hopefully other people will take care of that. And thanks, Preston.
Paul, thank you so much for having me.
And Courtney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Get involved with BARC and other groups working to protect our forests. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, Jenka Soderberg interviews Ellen Thomas, who has been part of the White House vigil to end nuclear weapons since 1984, about Proposition 1, a bill calling for the dismantling of all nuclear weapons in the U.S. and worldwide. And thank all of you KBOO members for your support. One last notice, dispatches from Rojava this Saturday, February 20, Anaris Info Shop, 8 to 10 p.m., 7101 North Lombard, with an anarchist author from California who will share their experiences and observations from a recent trip to this incredibly crucial area in northern Syria where the Kurdish people are standing up to the imperialist powers. Thank you so much for listening. This is Wednesday talk radio here on KBO. I'm ending here like a minute early. What have I done?
Cable Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is A Streetcar Named Desire, showing Thursday, February 18th at 7 p.m. Winner of 5 Academy Awards and considered the first dramatic jazz score of a film, 1951's A Streetcar Named Desire remains a landmark which forced the medium into a new, raw, emotional, mature kind of expression. Again, that's A Streetcar Named Desire, Thursday, February 18th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence. That's taking place February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus in Portland. This year's keynote speaker will be Dana Bjarnason, the Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of OHSU. Topics covered by the conference include flight nursing, forensic nursing, veteran care, public health nursing, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Student Nurses Association Convention 2016, Empowered for Excellence, taking place Saturday, February 20th from 8 to 4:30 at the PCC Sylvania campus, 12000 Southwest 49th Avenue in Portland. The Oregon Student Nurses Association, working to lead the future of nursing. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and the time is now just 9 o'clock. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9:30, Kristen Yount speaks with Rose Longoria of the Yakima Nation Fisheries about the Portland Harbor Superfund site and how it relates to the health of the Columbia River. And at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia.